We have any messages that we want to read in? Or?
Yes.
Oh, messages from the house.
January the 21st, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 5, Property Tax Refund Program Extension, Ayes 60. House Bill Number 22, Disabled Veteran License Plates, Ayes 60. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from Santa
Cruz. I have some more.
Are we still got some more House meetings?
January 21st, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading, passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 6, Airline Companies Assessment, Ayes 54, Noes 6. House Bill Number 7, Game Road Kill. Ayes 39, noes 21. House Bill 18, Drone Protection Act. Ayes 41, noes 19. House Bill Number 51, Excise Tax Well Site. Ayes 59, noes 1. And House Bill Number 52, Sales Tax Exemption Related Business Entities. Ayes 60. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from Standing Committee.
January 21st, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 18, Expungement of Misdemeanors. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Fladern, Senator Christensen, Chairman. January the 21st, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 11, Selling to Junk Dealers, ID Required. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Fladern, Senator Christensen, Chairman. January the 21st, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 78, Education Dual Language Immersion Program. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Cole, Pappas, Rothfuss, no, Senator Dockstader, Senator Co-Chairman. January the 20th, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agricultural State, Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 4, Dry Bean Research. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerich, and Geis, Senator Geis, Chairman. January the 21st, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 91, Charter School Eligibility Bonus Payments. Reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Coe, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Coe, Chairman. January the 21st, 2015, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 27, Vietnam Veterans Welcome Home Highway. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hassert, Wasserberger, No, Senators Perkins and Ross, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Cole.
Mr. President, Senate File 78, Education Dual Language Immersion Programs, and Senate File 91, Charter School Eligibility Bonus Payments, both have appropriations. Request they be re-referred to Committee Number 2.
Senate File 78 and 91 will be referred to Appropriations. I think that completes it. We're now ready, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, for bills on general file.
Mr. President, before we do that, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Senate, the Republican Majority Caucus, just a heads up, will be meeting tomorrow afternoon at the call of me, and it'll probably be sometime in general file or after general file, and one of the main things we're going to do is elect our representative, the Majority Caucus, to the Management Council. So be thinking about that. And those of you that are interested in running also be thinking about that. With that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself in the Committee of the Whole to discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's been adopted. Senator Coe.
Oh, the big man.
The Committee of the Whole, please come to order. First bill for our consideration, Senate File 26. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 26, Challenge Loan Interest Rate, an act relating to economic development, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 26, and I yield the floor to the Senator from Laramie, Mr. Rothfuss.
Senator Rothfuss. Well, it was. I turn to you on, Senator Rothfuss.
I just had it on here. I had a little green light.
There we go. Now it's off. Light. The light's on. Hello, everybody.
Which light is turned on?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'll just assume you were doing that intentionally. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring Senate File 26, Challenge Loan Interest Rate, on behalf of the Minerals Committee, and urge the body's favorable consideration. The Challenge Loan Program is a program implemented through the Wyoming Business Council, and it includes funds that have been continuously appropriated from the Economic Development Account Fund. A portion of that fund goes to the Challenge Loan Program, and those funds are made available on a challenge loan basis to support loans, typically but not always, given by banks to business enterprises. There are some circumstances in which a direct loan has been and can be given, but typically these are in cooperation with the banking community. Now, in statute right now, Mr. Chairman, you can see on page 2, There are limits on the bridge financing portion of the challenge loan account funding. And what that means, that's actually a bridge loan is a confusing concept. That's more of a traditional loan, equity stake loan that is not guaranteed. Right now, the challenge loan program can participate up to 35% of that loan or up to $1 million. The other opportunity is a guaranteed loan participation where you have a federally secured guaranteed loan, and right now the maximum participation rate is $1 million rather than $500,000. And then the loan rate currently in statute, you see on page 3, indicates that it would be not less than 4%. Now, this legislation makes those three changes. It increases the ceiling for the bridge financing to $1 million, increases the ceiling to the guaranteed loan participation to $2 million, and wants to decrease the floor of the available interest rate for the challenge loan program to 3%. Now, due to finance charges and the way that the business council actually uses these loans, it's typically one full percentage point higher because you need the origination and administration fees going into it as well. So a 4% loan would be what's available under this. Now, Mr. Chairman, when this program went into place, you had a circumstance where the prime rate was about 8.25%. So this low rate available of 4% was actually useful. It could influence things. There would be positive outcomes. It would be attractive to the banking community and to businesses. Now we're in a circumstance where the prime is so very low, 3.25%, that it's very difficult to utilize this in the manner in which it was intended. Mr. Chairman, this change, lowering it one point, can allow for that participation to take place and allow these funds that are currently available and to a large degree unused to become useful for economic development in the state. Right now, there are about $4.4 million of outstanding loans and $14 million of unobligated funds that the Wyoming Business Council currently has that are unlended and are not being used because the interest rates are not attractive enough to actually use them and motivate industry to do so. Mr. Chairman, one other point about why this is useful and how it goes into effect. What happens with this challenge loan program is that you'll have a banking entity that's willing to take on a loan, but perhaps not the entire loan. It might be risky. There might be some concerns. And the challenge loan comes in and supports that, for example, with 35% of the total loan amount. The bank facilitates the entire loan transaction. We have our 35% stake. The interest rate is blended from what the bank would be willing to do with what this challenge loan program is able to do. That brings the overall rate of the loan down. And it also shifts the risk component that the bank has to consider of loan to value. A lot of times they'll have an obligation to have a loan to value on it of only 75%. Maybe the business does not have 25% stake available. So this would blend it to the point where, due to the state taking on a portion of the risk, it might get to an 85% loan to value instead. So there's a lot of attractive advantages for industry as long as the rate's competitive. We're at a point now where the rate can't be competitive because we set the floor too high at a time when the prime rate was at 8.25%. So hopefully I explained it well enough the body can understand what this does, and hopefully we'll get a favorable consideration out of them. I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Questions on Senator Von Flader's motion that Senate File 26 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 26 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 14. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 14, Asset Forfeiture 2, an act relating to the Wyoming Controlled Substance Act, sponsored by the Judiciary. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Hicks, Kinski. No, Senators Esquivel, Von Flader, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I ask that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 14. To present that, there are amendments, if we could read those in.
Reading clerk, please read the amendment.
Senate File 14, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To present this bill and answer questions will be Senator Kinski.
Senator Christian, do you want to move the Standing Committee Amendment?
I've moved the Standing Committee Amendment. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, the committee chair, fellow members of the Iowa Senate,
I rise on behalf of your Senate Judiciary Committee to report on Senate File 14, Asset Forfeiture. First, a bit of background. In a prior session of the legislature, a bill on asset forfeiture was considered and failed. It was determined at that time that further study was needed. The issue was assigned as a topic to the Interim Joint Judiciary Committee. The committee listened and learned. Two bill forms were considered, and the version before you was ultimately approved for consideration by this body. I think at the outset it's important to set the proper tone for this discussion. There were, in the discussion of this issue, remarks made, not by members of this committee, but remarks by some in the public, which by the time those remarks made their way through the great echo chamber of the Internet, came to be perceived by some of our friends in law enforcement as not reflecting well on them or their work. So let's be clear. Such views are not reflective of your committee. We believe unanimously that the men and women of Wyoming law enforcement are brave people performing heroic work. They keep us safe from the predations of society's criminal element. God bless the men and women of Wyoming law enforcement. Senate File 14 is designed to bring clarity for law enforcement and the public to what is referred to commonly as Section 1049 of the Criminal Code, Asset Forfeiture. To quote one of our former co-chairs, the execution of the law has overall been good by law enforcement, but the statute is poorly written. How to rewrite that statute is a policy determination your Judiciary Committee brings before you in this legislation. Two necessary definitions, briefly. Seizure and forfeiture. Seizure is the taking into custody by the government of property on the basis of probable cause. The assertion that more likely than not, the property has been used in the commission of a crime. Forfeiture is the process by which, after seizure, the government keeps the property based on a determination that it was, in fact, used in the commission of a crime. The current standard of proof used in Wyoming, not specified in statute, is a preponderance of the evidence, or 51%. The federal standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. We have not reprinted the entire forfeiture statute in the bill, but let me share with you in a nutshell what forfeiture law provides. Section A says, in essence, here is the property that can be forfeited. Section B says, these are the conditions under which property can be seized. Section C says, forfeiture takes place under the procedure outlined in Section D. Section D has no procedure. So Section C says, use the procedure in Section D. Section D has no procedure. The focus of this bill is to remedy that and provide, in law, a clear procedure. Subsequent sections of the law provide for what is called summary forfeiture and destruction of drugs, plants, and equipment used in the manufacture of illegal drugs and substances. Those sections are unaffected by this bill. So let's review what this bill does not do. It does not lessen the penalties for drug offenses. It does not impair the ability of the government to summarily destroy illicit drugs and the instrument used in their manufacture. It does not limit the government's ability to seize property based on its determination of probable cause. It does not limit the government's ability to seek forfeiture used in the commission of the crime, such as a defendant's car or house or farm. The bill does not limit the government's ability to seize and forfeit unclaimed property. Your committee learned from law enforcement of situations where commercial vehicles were stopped, searched, and found within secret stashes of cash carried by those unsuspecting commercial vehicles. When law enforcement attempted to contact the shipper and the receiver, they found false names on the shipping documents and disconnected telephone numbers. Such property is subject to the Wyoming Unclaimed Property Statute and would revert to the general fund under the terms of that statute. Now, as to what SF 14 does do. First, it puts into law a clear procedure for the taking of property by the state. In the nomenclature of the bar, it codifies the rules, puts the rules into the code. The bill provides forfeiture can only take place after going before a judge and presenting evidence. That is the current unwritten practice adopted by the state of Wyoming to go before a judge. Second, and this is a change, this bill provides that evidentiary hearing must use a criminal standard of proof. That is, that the property was used in the commission of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The current unwritten practice adopted by the state is a civil standard, that is, by the preponderance of evidence, a far lesser burden of proof. Third, and this is a change, this bill provides that forfeiture must be determined by a jury only after that same jury convicts the defendant of the crime charged. These are changes in Wyoming's process, but they are not new to the law. What we have proposed in this bill was adopted from the federal rules for procedure. Fourth, the bill provides a process codified into law for protecting the rights of innocent parties who may hold an interest in the property. For instance, the bank that holds a mortgage on the farm that has been seized, or the wife who is a co-owner of the home that has been seized. Your committee, in codifying a change in the burden of proof from civil to criminal, puts before this body important policy questions. How can we best protect innocent citizens in a way that does not hamper drug-fighting efforts? Does the forfeiture of property merit a trial by jury in the same way that time in jail does? Should the legislative branch provide clear guidance in the law to the executive branch on forfeitures? Do we give people more protection before their property is taken, or do we leave things as is in the status quo? These are, in many respects, questions of our views of the U.S. Constitution and the protections afforded to property. There was a time in America where personal liberty and property rights were held nearly on the same plane. That changed in the Great Depression and the New Deal. In the 1930s, the U.S. Supreme Court signed off on economic regulations that said, in essence, property rights no longer merited the protections that personal liberty does. Over the decades, that distinction has brought us to the point where, to illustrate, you cannot throw a farmer in jail, that is, deprive him of his liberty, without a jury trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But you can shut down his farm and deprive him of his livelihood, his property, through regulation of his farm and land. No jury or proof required. More and more these days, the reaction across the land and in Wyoming is that we must treat property rights with greater deference from the government, and this bill is of a piece with that view. During the committee hearing process, we heard that while there may be problematic asset forfeitures in other states, there is no evidence of such in Wyoming. Your committee heard from proponents of the approach in this legislation that, nevertheless, it is best to write into law protection against the prospect of problems, which Senate File 14 does. There is one particular case that epitomizes the debate. It is a closed case, portion of which have been reproduced for you and are in your box. It involves a man traveling across Wyoming, stopped by law enforcement for speeding. I think it was 90 and a 75. He was found to have $17,000 in cash and a gun. He had a prior arrest and a misdemeanor conviction for marijuana possession. Traces of marijuana were found on the floor of the car, but not enough for a criminal charge. The cash and gun were seized. The man was released and never charged with a crime other than speeding. See the first two pages. Now we turn to the first two pages of the handout after the cash and gun have been seized. Based on the record provided, oddly enough, the man never sought return of the gun or cash. The state of Wyoming, to its credit, dutifully tracked him down. He was offered the return of $1,700 of his cash on the condition that he sign a form giving the remaining $15,300 to the state of Wyoming. This is the first two pages of the handout. The man retained legal counsel who evidently felt the entire $17,000 should be returned. Meanwhile, see the third page of your handout, in an internal memo, the state of Wyoming conceded that while the stop and search were valid, the cash and gun never should have been seized. Subsequently, and this is the fourth and fifth pages of the handout, the cash was returned, the gun kept, conditioned on the signing by the man of a release of the state of Wyoming for any and all claims, that is, a promise not to sue. Your committee knows nothing about this man other than what is in the file. We all may have questions as to his motives and the purpose of the cash. Some who spoke to our committee say that this is a cautionary tale. As to the man, possession of cash is not a crime. They take exception to the government seeking to keep 90% of the cash and characterizing it as a donation to the state. Some of these folks speaking to our committee took exception to the fact that all of the cash was given back only upon signing a release and a promise not to sue. Others before our committee said, consider not this man, but what if the person were instead a Wyoming citizen innocently caught up in the same kind of situation, whether a person who'd been stopped, or an innocent spouse, or a bank holding a mortgage. Still others before our committee said that perhaps a mistake was made in this case, but it was just a mistake. Otherwise, they see only the normal bargaining back and forth of the legal process, and getting a release is what any prudent lawyer would insist upon for his or her client. Besides, they argue, there are hundreds of other cases of forfeiture where everything, as far as we know, went right, and why focus just on this one case? So there you have it in one single illustration, all of the questions that were facing the committee and that face this body in consideration of Senate File 14. Keep things as they are, or write into law clear direction and protection with a higher standard of proof. With that, let's walk through Senate File 14. And as I do so, I will highlight for you the changes, and I will also highlight for you five minor amendments.
Senator Kinski, do you want to deal with a standing committee amendment this time?
Mr. President, I would move the standing committee amendment at this time.
It's already been moved. Do you want to deal with it at this time?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Please proceed.
Chairman. In summary, pages 2 to 8 contain new language, the process, and the balance of the pages through 16 are the current language with some changes, updates, and renumbering. So let's turn to page 2. The first substantive change begins on line 16, where the current language of subsection C, which says only prompt institution of proceedings, now provides that a person who is convicted of violation of the act, punishable by more than 1 year, that is a felony, shall be subject to forfeiture, and the procedure for forfeiture is outlined in subsections D through N. We now proceed to page 3, the all-new and improved subsection D, which states, except for summary forfeiture, that is, of drugs and the instruments of their manufacture, which are in the subsequent subsections, the court, and the bill says in line 4, shall order forfeiture, and the first committee amendment is to strike shall and substitute the word may. It was presented to our committee that we should not impinge upon the discretion of the court by saying shall forfeit, but rather may. Subsection little I specifies that the state shall, in its indictment, identify the property sought to be forfeited. On line 11 of page 3, Romanet number 2 provides that after a verdict or finding of guilty, if the defendant or a plea of guilty, if the forfeiture is contested, the court will conduct a forfeiture hearing. A brief hearing after which the court will enter a preliminary order. Again, on line 18, you'll see that our original committee bill had the word shall, and our amendment strikes that and puts in the word may. It was presented to us again that that infringes upon the discretion of the judge. Proceeding to line 21, Romanet 3 of the new procedure says that in its preliminary order of forfeiture, the court would order steps necessary to preserve the value of the property. Proceeding to page 4. Line 2, Romanet 4, at sentencing, the preliminary forfeiture order becomes final, although it remains preliminary as to third parties until a hearing is concluded as provided in the balance of the bill. Line 7, the court includes the forfeiture order in the judgment. Line 10, now, subparagraph E, this outlines the process of a case before a jury. Line 12, Romanet I, the court determines before the trial gets underway whether either the state or the defendant wants a jury. And if so, the court then knows that the same jury which has been impaneled will determine forfeiture if there is a guilty verdict. Here is the third committee amendment. On line 13, at the end of the line, after the word the, insert the word impaneled. On line 14, strike the words be retained to and insert the word also. So it reads, whether either party requests that the impaneled jury also determine the forfeitability. Proceeding to line 17, Romanet 2. If a party timely requests to have the jury determine forfeitability, the state then submits a special verdict form listing each item of property. To page 5, line 1, Romanet 3. If no party requests a jury timely, the court will then determine forfeiture. Line 6. If, after determination of a finding of guilt, the court orders forfeiture, third parties may now assert their legal interest. Line 10, Romanet little I, this provides for notice to all of those third parties, both by publication in the paper and by written notice of those reasonably appearing to be a claimant. Line 21, if the third party does file that they wish to assert their interest, the court conducts a hearing. Line 23, another amendment, striking of the word ancillary. That's the word used in federal code and it was felt by somebody presenting to the committee that that word was unnecessary. So you can see most of the committee, these committee amendments are housekeeping. Proceeding now to page 6. Lines 1 through 8 provide that the parties may have discovery, and after hearing, the court determines what the third party's rights are. Line 10 through 21 provides simply that if there's an appeal, the property is protected. Turning to page 7, line 1, and I think this is the final committee amendment. This provides a definition of the third parties. An interest, so let me read it to you. An interest in property belonging to a third party shall not be forfeited if the third party establishes, and here is the final committee amendment, it has a perfected lien in the property that was requested by the lending committee, or, and continuing by line 3, by a preponderance of the evidence that he is an innocent owner. Now the balance of the subsection defines what innocence is with respect to the property. Line 6, Romanet 1, for a property interest in place at the time of the violation of the Drug Act, an innocent owner means someone who, line 11, didn't know of the crime, or line 14, upon learning of the crime, did all they reasonably could to terminate such use of the property. Now, here's where something is added by the committee bill that is not contained under federal law. Lines 16 through 19. A person is not required to take steps that the person reasonably believes would be likely to subject any person to physical danger. This is an exception that is directed to, it's the wife, the girlfriend, the children exception. The wife or the girlfriend that knows the husband or the boyfriend's doing something wrong. They may additionally have children, and they're afraid to try and stop the crime, to try and intervene. Line 21, Romanet 2, is with respect to property interests acquired after the drug violation takes place, and over to page 8. Line 4, they have to be a bona fide purchaser or seller for value of the goods or services, or holder of a bona fide security interest. And line 8, subsection B, they did not know and was reasonably without cause to believe the property was subject to forfeiture. Proceeding then, line 11, H simply directs that the property is to be preserved until the proceedings have been exhausted, as well as appeals. Turning to page 9, now the balance of this, set lines 1 through 22 in the subsequent pages, are by and large a restatement and renumbering of existing statute, which is directed to the procedures for summarily forfeiture, that is, you don't get a hearing, of illicit drugs and the apparatus used for their manufacture, transport, and so forth, or their containers. So we'll briefly go through these, but line 10, when property is forfeited summarily, line 13, the commissioner, that is the attorney general, may retain it for official use. Line 16, may sell it or destroy it. Over to page 10, may require the board to take custody of the property. Line 7, may transfer ownership and control. Line 11, authorizes them to apply for destruction of contraband, the court providing further in line 16 through 21 that a court order is not necessary to destroy contraband after the criminal division has tested random samples for use as evidence. Page 11, then the procedures for destroying bulk quantities and maintaining the evidence for evidentiary purposes. Line 1, photographing. Line 6, extraction of samples. Line 10, weighing of samples. Line 14, retention of, line 16, certain ounces of organic material, line 20, grams of crystalline material, page 12, line 1, grams of liquid materials, line 4, provides that they, 4 through 8 provides there to retain sufficient amounts for the defense to test. Lines 10 through 15, destruction of bulk amounts over and above those specified for retention. And then 17 through 23, for the destruction of it upon order of the commissioner for anything no longer needed for evidentiary purposes. Page 13, line 2, again, summary forfeiture of various items of contraband. And now we go into line 11, specifying plants. Line 19 is the procedure for seizing plants growing upon somebody's property where that somebody doesn't have registration or proof that they're the holder thereof, over to page 14. Then line 5 on 14 provides for splitting or division of the proceeds between the state and the federal government, which probably isn't necessary after the determination by Attorney General Holder of last week. Page 14, line 17, provides for reporting by the Attorney General to the legislature on items other than those summarily forfeited, and those items are described then as those that are not used in the instrument of the crime on page 15, that the legislature is to get reports of those and so forth. So that is a run-through on the bill and the amendments. And in summary, the amendments are on page 3, changing shall to may in three places. Page 4, striking the word ancillary. On page 4 again, providing that the impaneled jury is to be used. And page 5, again, clarifying or shortening up the language on the same impaneled jury. Page 5, striking the word ancillary. And page 7, the only substantive change, which is insertion of a perfected lien in the property in the innocent owner section. I believe in the interest of economy, it may be best to proceed with consideration of the amendments.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment question, and probably really for some of the attorneys in the body, page 3, line 18, changing a shall to may. My question is, this is a fairly far in the procedure. You've had an individual that's been, their guilt's been established, and the ways are outlined here. You've had a contested forfeiture, and there's a decision been made on whether the forfeiture applies, and now we're giving the court discretion. The question is, on what basis does the court exercise that discretion? You know, if we were talking executive branch type things, you get major thing like this and you want to give them discretion, it's generally good practice to specify in the statute some of the reasons they may use to exercise the discretion, give some guidance as to how that works. What about in this setting? Is it appropriate to give the judge just total discretion? Does that open us to just arbitrary decisions? Is this change from shall to may appropriate at this point?
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman.
Bit, and we anticipate that we're going to take that particular question on that wording, and there's actually two may to shalls in there, and bring it back for a discussion in the Second Amendment when we have a little more time and kind of fresh minds on the deal. Not to interrupt any attorney opinions that want to weigh in at this point.
We are on the amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Question being called for. All in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment by Senator Christensen, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's been adopted. Back on the bill. Senator Cooper.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, it seems that there's been some concern by, I know, at least a couple of municipalities. Now, the question is that did any of the municipalities come before the committee? And if so, I guess my question is, did they express some concern for the way this bill was set up?
Further discussion, Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This was an interim topic, and it actually, as it moved along, we had quite a bit of discussion amongst the committee and with the attorneys involved and staff attorneys, but as far as public comment and local municipalities, there was very little input or none. So, no, that hasn't come before us.
Further discussion on Senate File 14. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, it does seem like this is a good and necessary bill. My question, for anybody that knows, this is in the Controlled Substance Act. There are other forfeiture provisions elsewhere in the statutes. I know of some in the game and fish area. Do they need a similar treatment or have the similar problems there already been solved? Is this something we need to either broaden this bill, or if this bill cannot be broadened, or that'd be going too far, do we need to continue the look at this whole topic and spread it to other forfeiture procedures?
Senator Christensen?
Chairman, thank you. There have been some conversations about other areas of seizure. However, this bill is directly tied to the drug statutes, been around since the early 70s, and so we chose to keep it limited there. That certainly doesn't preclude us from having other bills to come in the future addressing the topics you mentioned and some of the topics that citizens have come forward relating to other seizure issues.
Further discussion? Questions on Senator Christensen's motion that Senate File 14 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 14 is passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Landon.
Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 8. Would the reading clerk please read the Senate file?
Senate File 8, State Education Accountability and Assessment, sponsored by the Education Accountability. Yes, that's it. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cope.
Mr. Chairman, move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the do pass recommendation. And there is a standing committee amendment out of committee number 2, and we have a standing committee amendment as well out of committee number 4, and I'd move that amendment at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read? I think we missed a standing committee report. If we could read that in, please, and then we'll read in the amendments. Thank you, Senator.
It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Cole, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman.
Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, again, I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 8. Members of the Senate, just a little background on accountability, and actually started in the 2010 recalibration procedure that the legislature is required to do as a directive of the Supreme Court to recalibrate this K-12 prototypical funding model. We discovered at that time in the recalibration process that we were funding schools very well. So our focus shifted to accountability, and we passed the first piece of legislation on accountability in the 2011 session. Over the years, we've had different accountability bills. We've had different procedures we've gone through, but we've had problems. And I'm not going to allude as to what those problems were, but we had delays. And we had to delay different functions that took place in the accountability bill, particularly as it relates to Phase 2 and Phase 1. Understand that there's two phases in the accountability procedure. Phase 1 is the assessment side. In other words, how are the kids doing? But the second phase, Phase 2, which is the integral part of what we ultimately hope to accomplish, that's where we start tying student achievement to leader performance. That's the Phase 2 process. Draw your attention to two handouts, and I want to tell you also that the Education Committee, we have divided up different sections in this, so we all have buy-in. We also have two new members that are new to the committee and thought it was appropriate to divide up that process as we present the bill. Draw your attention to this handout. This is what I'm going to follow first. This is what I'm going to follow first. It's titled Senate File 8, State Education Accountability and Assessment. And the second one, which is something that's new, is the implementation timeline that we handed out. And I think this is probably one of the most important pieces you'll get a chance to look at. We put this all into perspective. It's like a matrix that tells you, going out to 2018 and 19, where we hope to be as we continue the accountability process. So this bill is brought to you as a result of the interim work of the Select Committee on Statewide Education Accountability. The Select Committee is a committee that's been ongoing since 2011. We meet in the interim. You'll see also in this bill that we reconstitute that Select Committee. We feel we have to stay working. We have to keep on working on accountability. So it continues that operation. Two sections amending existing statutes. Section 1, which I think is important, amend statutes impacted by powers versus the state. Senate File 10, which we passed this body earlier, that's a result of the Supreme Court decision on the constitutionality of Senate File 104. Don't know anything about that. And Section 2, which amends statutes that were not changed as a result of the case, or Senate File 10 as well. Wyoming Accountability and Education Act, starting into the Phase 1 part of it, requires a review of local district assessment systems for schools designated as not meeting expectations. Do that every 5 years. Phase 1 also eliminates the language providing that a school principal may be dismissed in the event a school fails to meet improvement goals under the Accountability Act for 2 consecutive years. Also in Phase 1, it eliminates the intervening review by the PJP Professional Judgment Panel for schools challenging their school score as determined under Phase 1. Phase 1 also requires the WDE to convene a technical advisory group to create a school accountability model appropriate for alternative schools. This was a discussion we had last year, bringing alternative schools into the accountability mix, and you'll see that we make some adjustments to that. getting into phase two, what we did, and you're going to see in the Standing Committee Amendment, we further delayed this. Delays implementation of the leader accountability system until 2016. You're going to see in the Standing Committee Amendment that we decided to delay that even further. Also delays the implementations of the teacher accountability system, it says, until 2017. You're going to see in the amendment we delay that even further. Why are we delaying this stuff? Folks, we've had no cooperation over the last 2 years. Just that simple. No collaboration and no cooperation. We just couldn't get things done. I think the timeline was too short. Also, in phase two, it adopts general guidelines to be utilized. In phase two, teacher and leaders, including a requirement that only 20% of a leader-teacher performance score can be based on student performance and growth. The remaining 80% is based on multiple measures of professional practice. Going to statewide assessment, this requires the state board to convene a statewide student assessment task force. That's in the bill. Requires the task force to include representatives of small schools, large schools, and schools from all regions. Requires that the task force include representatives from district and school administration, school district assessment, curriculum directors, elementary, secondary teachers, school district board members, higher education representatives, and Wyoming business community. In the assessment side, it modifies administration of the Work Keys assessment, and you'll hear more about that later, to give 12th graders that option, currently only 11th graders. And modifies administration of the ACT in 11th grade. Remember that we changed here, I can't remember, a couple of years ago, that we decided that in the 11th grade, the ACT test would be the assessment test. That's the test that students, we feel, have the most buy-in. That's how they qualify for Hathaway. That's how they go on to college, wherever they might decide to go. Graduation part of this, we eliminate the tiered diploma. Interesting part coming up next in graduation. We require 4 years of math for graduation in the bill, currently three. Want to note also that the Hathaway Success Curriculum to require 4 years of math as well. School district assessment system that streamlines the state's review of local school district assessment systems required in the State Board of Education once every 5 years. Goes on and provides all school districts 2 full school years to incorporate the revised content and performance standards into their assessment systems. That's a breakdown on the bill. So with that, I think I'll start deferring to other members of the committee for their presentations. I think page 1 through 23, Senator Dockstader will present. And at the end of the presentation, I'll stand up and go through this matrix for you. Senator Dockstader will now proceed.
Senator Cole, before we go to Senator Dockstader, do we want to deal with the Standing Committee Amendment at this time, or do you want to save that until the end of the description of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to deal with that at the end because that's where we make the changes.
Okay. Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through this process, so I'll note where those standing committees, at least the first part of those amendments, come in. Members of the Senate, I'll just go over some highlights here. Two sections amending Title 21. The first section amends those provisions of statute impacted by the Supreme Court ruling in Powers versus Hill. Section 2 amends provisions of Title 21 not impacted by the case. Let's go to page 2, lines 11 through page 4, line 17. Addresses the requirement of the state superintendent to administer the college entrance exam and the job skills readiness exam. This bill provides the option to take the job skills assessment to 12th grade as opposed to 11th. This recommendation came from the state board to allow the students an additional year of learning prior to the assessment. It also gives the state superintendent flexibility in administration of the ACT, allowing her latitude to establish a time for administration that best fits the needs of all of the students. Currently, it requires administration to enroll in the senior year necessary for qualification at Hathaway. So that was prescriptive before. Page 4, lines 19 through 23. Page 5, line 10, modifies the requirements associated with the district assessment systems, streamlining the process, requiring the state to review or audit only every 5 years. and requiring only that the district submit or attest to their plans every year. Currently, that's annually. Page 5, line 12 through 8, excuse me, page 5, lines 12 through page 8, lines 18. That also addresses the aspect of the school district assessment systems requiring review of a struggling school's assessment system under the Accountability Act, because under the provisions of this bill, there will no longer be that annual review. Page 8, line 20 through page 9, line 20, that conforms the school district to statutes to the requirements discussed relating to the administration of the college readiness exam and the job skills assessment. Let's go to bottom of page 9. That begins where we start talking about Section 2. Page 10, line 6 through page 11, line 22, it amends the review process of the school-level scores under the Wyoming Accountability in the Education Act, eliminating the intervening review of the professional judgment panel. Now, currently, the schools receive a score. They can ask for review by the PJP and then by the State Board. This, taking it back just to the PJP, this was a recommendation by the State Board because the process was considered cumbersome. Page 12 through 14, this modifies graduation requirements and diplomas. This is related to the school district assessment systems, requires 4 years of math, as noted, and eliminates the tiered or endorsed diplomas requiring course completion as a measure, Mr. Chairman. The amendments, which we'll come to in a moment, but I can note them here, pages 15 and 16. Delays Phase 2, Leader Accountability, 2018 to 2019. That's part of the Standing Committee Amendment. Teacher Accountability, 2017-2018. That's also part of the amendment. Pages 17, lines 2 through 12, also relates to the district assessment system, conforming the district statutes to require submission of a plan every year to the State Board. But recall the State Board will review or audit once every 5 years, unless it's identified as a struggling school under the Accountability Act. Pages 17, lines 14 through page 18, line 19. This is conforming language to the delay in Phase 2. Pages 18, lines 21 through page 20, line 20, conforming amendments for the changes to the district assessment systems and graduation requirements. Page 20, line 22 through page 21, line 12. This addresses the delay of Phase 2, leader accountability again. Page 21, lines 14 through 23, conforming amendments to the district statutes for the changes in the district assessment system and graduation requirements. Almost finished, Mr. Chairman. Page 22, lines 1 through 15, conforming amendments to the teacher contract statutes that reflect the delay in the implementation of Phase 2 teacher accountability. And page 22, line 17 through page 23, line 8, conforming amendments to the Hathaway Success Curriculum to require 4 years of math. And the repealers on 23, that's the school reviews by the PJP and the three levels of endorsement. With that, I'll turn it back to our chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dockstetter. Senator Coe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this time, starting on Section 4, on page 23, Senator Raffas will present Section 4.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Section 4 is basically the continuation of the education accountability work. It's broken out into a few different sections. Under Section A on page 23, we simply have the continuation of the select committee and indicate that it shall continue through December 31st, 2016, basically comprised in the same form as it is right now. On page 24, in Section B, calls for the continuation of the technical advisory committee that we've had working with us over the past few years. So those are authoritative experts, membership by superintendents from school districts, teachers, and other technical experts that we've had advise us in the past, making sure that they continue as well. On page 25, Section C is support by the LSO staff. We'd like that to continue. That would be a lot handier. On section page 25, Section D begins the discussion of what the Phase 2 study and work is going to look like over the next year. Now, remember, as the good senator from Park County mentioned, we've had some delays. We actually intended to be doing a lot of this work over this last interim, but lost that opportunity. And so we're going to be developing the phase two and trying to roll it out in effectively a pilot form over the next year and then try and implement it thereafter. So as we look on page 26, you see that language about the fact that we're trying to design a framework on line one for a teacher and school district leader evaluation and accountability system. That is phase two, together with a system of supports for school districts and the piloting of phase two system components within volunteer school districts. So we'll try and roll this out on a small scale to begin with based on the recommendations of the experts and of the committee. Hope that works, and then based on what they find, we'll develop the phase two and roll it out statewide later on. Components within the phase two are included on page 26. It goes back to what good Senator Dockstetter said a few moments ago about the various components that go into the system. And going on to page 27, Romanet 2 indicates the identification. This is, again, work that needs to be done by both the select committee and our technical advisory committee that is designing the framework. We're looking at them to identify multiple measures for professional practice and evaluation of teacher and school leader performance, articulation of those best practices and implementation thereof in Romanet 3. In Romanet 4 on page 27, how we should incorporate student growth percentiles into the evaluation of teachers and leaders, particularly with consideration and recognition that some subjects are perhaps easier to do that with than others. Page 28, Romanet 5, looks at ways to identify the standards and descriptions for the quality levels necessary for high-performing teachers and leaders. And then in Romanet 6, trying to find common performance level descriptors for all districts in a narrative component to differentiate teachers and leaders at various levels of performance. In other words, how do we give concepts statewide, recognizing that there'll be variations between how districts do this, but to set standards of performance for various levels of teachers and leaders in schools? And Romanet 7 on 28 is using a common decision matrix to try and get to those final ratings so that we have some commonality statewide. Little E on page 28 simply talks about the development and refinement and piloting of the teacher and school district leader evaluation and accountability system subject to the following criteria. So this goes into some criteria related specifically to how that system would be laid out. Moving on to page 29. And you see in Romanet 1, first priority was the maximization of school district control over the evaluation process, making sure that this evaluation is taking place within the context of that school district and that they have control over it, subject to some of the following considerations. Romanet 2 is that the teacher and leader evaluation be comprised of, and then obviously we're looking for best practices at a minimum where teachers are being evaluated by their leaders. But in a lot of districts, that's sort of where it ends now, and we wanted more than that, so you can see in little B there that we're trying to come up with a meaningful process and methodology for teachers to meaningfully evaluate their school building and school district leadership on an individual basis. So not just the top-down evaluation, but the bottom-up evaluation, and then we extend that a little further and see that the process and methodology for building leadership to meaningfully evaluate peers and district leadership. We basically kind of want everyone to evaluate everyone else in some meaningful manner so that we get as much information and the districts get as much information as possible in that evaluation. We heard a lot of testimony and complaints over time about biases and unfairness in specific evaluation systems, so we wanted to give a broad opportunity for that evaluation to be put forward. Little D, appropriate systems to maintain anonymity for those evaluations. And little E on page 30, a procedure for reporting those results of evaluations to all stakeholders in a transparent and timely manner. And then finally, the Romanet 3 for these considerations is the use of rigorous teacher and leader evaluations, providing for multiple source feedback, which we had testimony on for methodology to ensure that the evaluation system is fair and comprehensive. Finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 30 is a discussion simply of the reporting that the advisory committee and the Department of Education shall periodically report to the select committee, and then it goes on to discuss some of the reports that we're looking for. Mr. Chairman, that brings me to the conclusion of section 4, and I will hand it back over to the good chairman of the Education Committee.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, to present Section 5 and 6, I defer to Senator Pappas.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Esteemed gentlemen of the Senate and our honored Queen, I'm happy to shepherd you through Section 5 and 6 of this bill. Basically, Section 5 establishes a technical advisory group, and the task of the advisory group is to develop a valid and reliable accountability model, specifically for alternative schools. The model shall conform to principles and purposes specified within the Education Accountability Report. The technical advisory group shall work in consultation with the advisory committee to the Select Committee for Statewide Education Accountability, as noted in Section 4, and it provides a date for the department to report its recommendations for model implementation to the Select Committee. Going on to page 32, lines 1 through 5, the Select Committee will report its recommendations to the legislature in the 2016 budget session. Moving on to lines 7 through 15, the alternative school shall receive informal reporting under the Wyoming Accountability Education Act and shall be exempt from school-level performance ratings and aggregate district scoring. Further on to lines 17 through 23 basically allows for per diem and travel expenses to be given to members that are non-governmental employees. So that's basically Section 5. Section 6 on page 33 establishes a task force, and the State Board will conduct a review and evaluation of the statewide assessment system using a task force to assist them in the review and evaluation process. Page 34, the first lines 1 through 8 basically defines the makeup of the task force. Lines 10 through 17 will establish a date for its formation and again allows for per diem and travel expenses for non-governmental employees. Going on to lines 19 through 23 on page 34, authorizes the LSO to assist the State Board in its review and evaluation process. Now, if you'll turn to 35, paragraphs 1 through basically 11 will sets a date for the State Board to report its recommendations on the approach for a future statewide assessment system. And then it also will report on the transition from the existing mechanism and process of an assessment system to whatever the new system will be recommended. Lines 13 through 21, the State Board and Department of Education basically are required to report progress to the Select Committee with its final recommendations on October 15, 2015. Moving on to page 36, the final portion of Section 6 basically also again states that the committee will report its findings to the recommendations to the legislature in the 2016 budget session. Mr. Chairman, that concludes Section 6.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, I run a cleanup. My good friend, Senator Anderson, on Section 7, the money.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To continue on in regard to Senate File 8, starting with Section 7 regarding appropriations, page 36, line 7. Section 7 contains only an additional $35,000 from the School Foundation Program account, but it also redirects $1 million previously appropriated in the 2014 budget bill. During the 2014 budget session, the legislature reappropriated $1 million from the Wyoming Department of Education's budget year 13-14 appropriations back to the Department of Education for, quote, managing the implementation and for building agency capacity, supporting the statewide education accountability system created under Wyoming Statute 21-2204, and the teacher and leader evaluation accountability system required of the State Board of Education under Wyoming Statute 21-2304. So all under these 2014 laws, Chapter 26, Section 2, Section 206, and also under footnote 5. Going on, page 36, line 9, this discussion is in regard to Section 7, little a, where we continue to allocate $750,000 or as much as thereof as is necessary to be expended by the Department of Education to immediately provide a system of support to school districts based on their 2014 performance ratings. Page 37, line 7, section 7, little b, reallocates $250,000 to the State Board of Education to carry out the necessary work for the statewide assessment task force in Section 3. So you see there $750,000 to go to the department, $250,000 to then go to the board, comprising the $1 million that we talked about earlier that was reallocated. Going on, page 38, line 2, section 7C, this then speaks to the appropriation mentioned earlier of $35,000 from the school foundation program to the legislative service office for necessary expenditures related to the select committee on statewide education accountability and the advisory committee to the select education. A bit of a side note, there was, of course, as we've talked about, $35,000 appropriated to the LSO for the Select Committee during the 2014 interim. As I understand, the question was asked by Senate Appropriations in regard to kind of where are we in regard to those, to that appropriation. It's my understanding that the conversation within Appropriations said that there is now approximately $20,000 left from that appropriation, which will be reverted on June 30th, 2015. And again, I only mention that because that was brought up in Senate Appropriations. That's pretty much in a nutshell. I think you'll see earlier it was mentioned how we had a start and then a pause and then a restart. That's kind of what you see here, appropriation, authorization, reappropriation, reauthorization, and really a relatively small amount during this time in order to assist the LSO and others and the Select Committee in continuing their work. Mr. Chairman, that completes my portion, and I believe that does bring us to the end of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to deal with the Standing Committee Amendment at this time. I think it's been read in, and I moved it.
No. Let's have that read in, Senator.
Read in again, if you would, please, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 8, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 17, line 15.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 8. What this does is what we all kind of alluded to as we went through the bill. Phase 2 of accountability, which is the how we tie student achievement to leader performance. And, you know, this is far and away the most difficult part of accountability. You'll see in here what we really did. We moved out the leader evaluation 1 year. And we moved out the teacher evaluation 1 year to 2018 and 19, and the leader evaluation to 2017 and 18. Just did not feel that the time frame was too tight. This is the most difficult part of it, so that's why we did that. And then on page 37, line 12, and 37, line 22, that's just a error there that we changed. I'd ask for your consideration of the Standing Committee Amendment.
Do I hear a question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Culp.
Mr. Chairman, just draw your attention again to this matrix graph here. I'm not going to go through the whole thing because it's pretty much self-explanatory. It takes us from year 2014-15 to 2018-19. It's the implementation timeline for the State Education Accountability and Assessment as amended by the Senate Education Committee. With that, any of us would stand for questions on Senate File 8.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the good chairman of the Education Committee could talk a little bit about the requirement that 20% of the leader teacher's performance is based on student performance and the rest on other areas. It seemed to me that student performance is the thing that drives this, yet the relationship 20 to 80 seems a little out of whack, so could we have some more discussion about that, please?
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you may recall that when we started this endeavor, we had it nearly 100%, if not the only component, was basically test scores, and that was the original thought with our phase two, is that we would take test scores, we would tie them to teachers, and we would have a great system that worked wonderfully, and that sounded perfect. And then we had several years of testimony telling us how bad of an idea that actually was for a large variety of reasons, using that and that alone. Mr. Chairman, we agreed, and the Technical Advisory Committee agreed, that you want that to be a portion when you can get there, but you don't want that to be the main component because it will inhibit cooperation among teachers, team teaching, handing off more difficult students to more experienced teachers, and a lot of the types of things that we have learned are the most effective teaching strategies become more difficult when you start imposing stronger ties between the test scores and the teacher. That's one side of it that we heard. The other side of it is how very, very difficult it is in a modern school system to actually track specific test scores to teachers in many, if any, subjects. In some circumstances where you have mathematics, for example, there can be a reasonable tie, and the test is meaningful with the topics that you're learning. But other testimony we've heard over the years indicates that you have partial learning depending on a series of different teachers that you would have to apportion test scores to. So experience in other states from, and this is what our experts told us, experience in other states indicates that while it sounds like a good idea, those test scores do not end up correlating very well with teacher performance when you actually put it into practice. There's no good system for that yet. So again, the consultants, the experts that we've brought in have told us that you want to try and link that, you want to use that as a component of it, but that dividing it up into a series of different areas for the evaluation is the most effective strategy to actually coming up with which teachers are performing well and which aren't over a longer period of time. So, again, we started off, I think, where the good majority floor leader was and ended up moving pretty substantially away from that position.
Senator Wasserberger.
Oh, he turns it on up there. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a number of questions for the people on the committee. I know they've put in a lot of time on this, but my question is, last spring, the state of Wyoming, due to, I'm not sure what, lost its waiver for the No Child Left Behind Act, and now is required to meet 100% of its students meet expectations, and I'm wondering how or why. It appears to me in this bill we're trying to match or address federal issues when, one, we can't ever meet the Fed's requirements, and two, we don't know what the federal government is going to do. So if we could have an explanation on that. The second one is we have some evaluations by teachers, and having been an administrator for 14 years at a middle school, I had the very unfortunate opportunity to have to terminate continuing contract teachers, and I'm just wondering, those teachers would have the opportunity to be anonymous and then evaluate me while I would be public evaluating her and what she's doing and how that will impact your score. But lastly, why have we put in a four-year math requirement, and how will that impact our small schools, and how will that impact the students in their senior year, actually, when they're getting ready to go out either in the job world or go directly to a junior college? And I agree with the sponsors that all students going to college should take 4 years of math. But two-thirds of your school are not going to be going onward to college. They would be actually going directly into the workforce or actually into an associate's program at a local junior college for technical skills and career opportunities that way. So those are my concerns. I'm really worried about how that four-year requirement will impact our elective teachers and how it will impact small schools.
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure how to answer the waiver. My understanding was we applied for a waiver and were denied the waiver, if I'm correct. But I will try to answer one of your questions, and maybe somebody else from the committee can answer the rest. You know, as far as the 4 years of math goes, in all of the different approaches we've had, or all the different evidence presented to us that I've seen, particularly out of North Carolina, Indiana, other places, 4 years of math is a driver of success in college. Can't totally explain why. I think it has to do with the rigor involved with taking math when you're a senior. Taking 4 years of math, getting used to that type of rigor. We, as far as small schools go, understand that the Supreme Court has required the state to provide equal opportunity to all kids in the state, no matter where they live. We have the Hathaway Success Curriculum in place, which provides for 4 years of math, except for the one change you saw in the provisional scholarship area, which we put 4 years of math into that. So that's required. And I can tell you that we did small school adjustments in the funding of the K-12 prototypical model to give them more money. They're providing that access to 4 years of math right now, because even the small schools have kids that want to do Hathaway scholarship. As far as the evaluation of teachers, I might defer to somebody else on the committee to maybe answer that question. Hope I answered your question on 4 years of math and the waiver. I really don't know totally what the waiver is all about right now.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we were doing our best in the accountability model early on to meet all the No Child Left Behind requirements. And we're hoping that we would be able to get the waiver so that our accountability system would meet the federal standards, and therefore we would be able to exempt ourselves from No Child Left Behind. So obviously this has been under production for quite some time, and that was the original intent. Now my understanding is that we had applied, it was denied, they're not really granting waivers anymore. We're in a situation where we have to have a 100% adequate or advanced to meet your adequate yearly progress. So we are in an awkward situation, and this legislation is still compliant with No Child Left Behind. We have discussed other legislation that might come forward that might move a little bit beyond some of those requirements. But at this stage, this, to the best of our understanding, is consistent with No Child Left Behind and would still be compliant. I hope that clarifies that to some degree. As far as terminating teachers anonymous versus public, I think it makes a good point, but I'll just point out that the phase two, that discussion, was we want our technical advisory group to come up with practices that will implement these concepts so that we have multiple peer reviews, so that we have different levels of analysis. And what we're asking them to do effectively is to sort through the same types of experiences that you've had and come up with business rules that will allow those concepts to be implemented, but without the, the types of problems that you've identified, because the people who are on that technical advisory group are people such as yourself that have had practical experiences in that world and should hopefully be able to share their experiences as well and say, well, this is a concern, this is a concern, this is a concern. Here are business rules that will allow us to adapt to those situations. And we're hopeful that we'll be able to come up with a system that would address that same type of consideration. And, Mr. Chairman, the final point was with regard to the 4 years of math and the concept that two-thirds of the students are going to not be going to college. Well, you know, when I hear that, those are the ones that I most want to have the fourth year of math, because if that's the last opportunity for mathematics they're going to have is whether or not they get 4 years in high school and then they're going to go into their career. There aren't too many careers or really life paths out there where understanding math and math comprehension just aren't going to help you out. So I'd be hopeful that we could do something to ensure that all of the students graduating from Wyoming high schools are as strong in mathematics as is possible, because it's only going to help the state and help those individuals. Even if they think they hate math and will never need to use it, I find myself using mathematics an awful lot.
Senator Anderson, and then we'll come back to Senator Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think for clarity, my position as I stand now is not so much one as a member of the Education Committee, but just as a member of this body. I want to share a concern that was expressed earlier by the good senator from Campbell County in regard to the 4 years of math and how that might apply itself to small schools. And I'm not sure whether the senator was there when we had that conversation in committee or not, but anyway, my position in terms of an individual, and I by no means speak for the committee, nor am I really speaking as a member of the committee, I too have concerns in regard to the fourth year of math. I said in committee, I was not prepared to strike out four and put in three. I support the idea of 4 years of math, but I have concerns in regard to the resources and the ability for small schools to deliver that. Not to get off into the weeds, but it also, in thinking about the ability for small schools to provide, I think about the conversation we had in regard to school security and resource officers and the ability for small schools to be able to deliver that. There are a number of other things where small schools have expressed their difficulty in achieving that. So here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest that we keep in the back of our minds with upcoming recalibrations a manner and means, and I actually kind of issued this as a challenge to some of the small school advocates, to help us find accommodations for those small schools by which they can provide some of the things, fourth year of math, other things that I mentioned. And so then in our conversation about accommodations and providing necessary resources, we come back and really take a look at this in our recalibration efforts. To the extent, I might even suggest to the Management Council this might be an interim. I have within my district 5-6 small schools, and these are then real problems. And so I just leave that for you, for your thought in regard to number one, what resources could we provide in order for them to be successful at? Number two, what kind of accommodations could we provide for those small schools in order to achieve that? In regard to the position of the middle-level administrator having such a high level of accountability, and I'm just going to cast this out, but that middle-level, and I was never one, but that middle-level administrator is in a very difficult position in this accountability model, in that he has not the ability to choose those people that are working under him, and just it has been expressed in regard to the ability to evaluate or to terminate. And I just inject into your thinking, into the thought of what implications that has for continuing contract, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Senator Hicks, and then we'll go to Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, on this discussion of 4 years of math, sometimes I think we miss the mark, or sometimes we assume that quantity is quality. And I would concur with the good senator from Albany County. For those people that are at a remedial level, they're probably the ones that most need the 4 years of math. But the real challenge is in these rural schools is these really bright kids that are excelling, that the limitations on the ability to access some of these really highly advanced math class. So my really question is, are we hung up on quantity or should we be focused on quality? In other words, should we set the bar of it to get out of high school? You had to have passed a certain level of mathematics, and rather than just a certain number of hours in mathematics. I think we're missing the mark here, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Compliments to the Education Committee, the Chairman. Good work, good bill. I do have some concerns about the 4-year math. You know, it seems like I don't know what the electives are, what we're down to now as far as student electives in 9 through 12 in high school. But it seems like every year I'm down here, we rob another elective from our students. And so that's a concern. And I'd like to know how many electives are left. The other thing, on page 30, line 2, mentions stakeholders. These reporting results, evaluations to all stakeholders, define that. I hope that includes school boards, everybody else that's involved in, and not just the teacher and the principal or the superintendent. I think the school boards are critical in getting those reports and making those decisions as well. I'm sure. I hope it does. The other concern I had was similar to my colleague from Campbell County in teachers evaluating principals and district leadership. I don't know about that one. I have my concerns. I think that's happening naturally every day in the teacher's lounge. I think it's a good bill. I think it's something that we need to go forward with. I too have concerns about our department, and maybe the committee, members of the committee, could maybe share a little light on the discussion of our department, if they feel that the dates that have and the deadlines for this to be implemented are realistic. We've had frustration in the last 2 years. We understand the reasons, but maybe you could share with us the discussion that was had with the department and those deadlines and trying to meet those deadlines of this concept of pilot programs. I like the evaluation process. I think it's a step in the right direction, and I'll be looking forward to getting those reports of how those evaluations how this pilot program has turned out. So thank you.
Senator Culp. Oh, excuse me. Senator, I'm going to go to Senator Escobel, and then we'll come back to Senator Culp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering, we've talked about 4 years of math. I heard a good colleague from Albany County mention something about some students hating math. And I was just wondering, how would a math teacher be evaluated if a good percentage of the students in his or her class had failing grades? What effect would that have on the evaluation of that particular teacher? Because I know that graduation rates are viewed with favor, regardless of the quality of the education. And I was just wondering how that math, students in math classes or chemistry or whatever class that is fairly rigorous, what effect that would have on the evaluation of the teacher.
Senator Culp.
Well, Mr. Chairman, going to the good senator from 45 miles east of me somewhere, Cali or wherever it is, my good friend, on page 30, the advisory committee is a committee that already exists, and what this particular paragraph does is reconstitute them like we do the select committee, and it does, in fact, have the stakeholders that you were questioning on that committee. There's only one member from the business community that I remember, but the rest of them are stakeholders, superintendents and whatever. Talking about math, you know, the comment was made that kids just need to get out of high school, and that if you do 4 years of math, they might not be successful at doing that. Well, let me tell you that at our community colleges today, the percentage factor of kids graduating from Wyoming high schools that go to community colleges, 46% are going into remedial math. The other thing in the career tech field, you can't just get by with a little math anymore. Companies out there want kids, if they're going into career tech, for instance, and there's a big gas company down in southwest Wyoming. I know what they require of kids, you know, people they're going to hire. So it's not just about getting out of high school. This is about being able to go from the career tech level on up to higher levels. And math is an integral part of that. Maybe my good friend, my good colleague from Laramie can answer the question from the senator from Cheyenne. I didn't hear it that well. Maybe somebody over there could answer it.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try and address a few of the questions my good friend from Carbon County regarding access and kind of the approach to mathematics education. Those are good points. Quality versus quantity is certainly something that's essential, and we need to make sure that everybody is elevated to a certain level. One of the things that, as the accountability group, we did was we asked the State Board of Education to go out and consider the possibility of doing just exactly what you said about the idea of that's an end-of-course type concept. You have to achieve a certain level and prove that you're capable of passing, and that's the way to get out. And they came back unanimously saying that they didn't support that idea. And honestly, there was not a lot of analysis as to why they did not support that idea, but to the extent that they came back unanimously and told us they didn't want us to go that direction, we didn't. And we ended up pursuing the concept of looking at course requirements for graduation, and that's one of the components of this, is the course requirements approach to a graduation or a degree requirement in the state of Wyoming. It's also very consistent with the Hathaway Success curriculum, so in one way it's at least statutorily consistent. So I'll say that I think it's a reasonable approach, but they're two very different approaches, and we chose from a policy standpoint not to pursue that track. I'm not averse to the concept either, but that was not the direction we went. As far as access in these communities to the advanced levels of mathematics, that's one of the areas where we need to make sure that we're working on our outreach programs, our online courses, and access to our local colleges, as well as the university, to try and facilitate and advance that. It is a concern. But one of the things that we've discussed in committee a lot is the idea, Mr. Chairman, that if you have a problem where kids in a district are unable to take 4 years of math because there isn't sufficient resources, and 4 years of math is a requirement for the success curriculum, but they're coming back and saying, I'm sorry, we can't teach all our kids 4 years of math. That is a fundamental problem that has to be dealt with. That's not a reason to move against a policy. That's a reason to figure out why we can't implement that policy and then provide the appropriate resources so that all of those students would be available to take the 4 years of math, because they should all be able to take the success curriculum and compete for the Hathaway. So that goes to the recalibration comment that my chairman discussed. Let's see. With regard to good senator's discussion about electives and the consideration of not having enough time and always adding more, I did some quick math and looked at the success curriculum, because districts can have different levels of requirements, and I didn't have the baseline analysis, so I just went with the success curriculum, knowing that that's a greater threshold that includes 4 years of math than any of the graduation requirements. If you assume a seven-hour day, which is common unless you do the block schedule, typically you'll have 28 units, 28 course years in high school. 19 of those course years are the success curriculum, leaving 9. So roughly a third of your time, a little more than a third of your time, is available for elective, even under the strictest, most rigorous requirements that we have available in the state. So it still leaves a lot of flexibility. And, again, a fourth year of math in some of our views is critical for that. And finally, with regard to my good colleague from here in Laramie County, the concern being if folks are hating mathematics, how is that going to affect the course grade or the course score? Well, that is part of teaching, is having students that are struggling and that dislike it. The reality is that's one of the reasons why we wanted to make sure that there were many different factors that were involved in the assessment of the teacher, not just the test scores. If you have students that hate it and they're students that struggle, they don't like mathematics, then their scores may be one partial reflection of your ability to teach, but there are other things like the growth parameter and just how well you interact, what your colleagues think of you, your reviews from the principal. All of those things need to be in a cohesive package. And we want to make sure that that exact problem doesn't end up being a reason that a teacher is evaluated poorly because their students dislike mathematics. So it is a concern. And I hopefully I addressed all of the concerns of the senators that have spoken so far. I'm happy to answer more questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wasserberger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My last question has to do with the 11th grade ACT test, and I was just wondering what standards we're following with that test and the standards we've chosen in Wyoming, if the ACT actually measures those.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The answer from the vendor is that they have been conforming over the last few years to meet those standards, and theoretically the answer is yes to that question. Now, I say theoretically because our consultants that do these analyses are not entirely convinced that they're fully aligned yet, but the simple answer is they're doing their best to get them into line with the standards that we're currently using in the state.
Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple really short ones, a softball for you. On page 10, you moved the requirement on the panel for the school received its final rating. You moved it from 30 days to 15, and I'm guessing there's a good explanation for it that's there. The other thing I'd like to know, have you guys considered how much burden you're placing as far as reporting and paperwork on districts and school boards? It appears to me this Federal Paperwork Reporting Act, we may need to go to a state one because you guys are requiring phenomenal amounts, or we are. I shouldn't say you guys, we are. We're requiring substantial amounts of reporting. Our system, and we all get it, we've got way too much testing, and we're putting a burden on our local schools and boards that I'm not sure is doing a lot to educate children. It's doing a lot to do reporting. I see some problems there. Back to the four-year math deal, 46% can't meet remedial math into junior colleges. For that 46%, a fourth year is not going to do a thing, folks. We need to worry about year one probably the most. Year two is going to count quite a little. Year three, a little bit. These smaller schools, it's almost impossible to get a fourth year. You know, we've got to the point now that we dictate 100% of the curriculum in little schools. By the time you add 2 years of Spanish, 4 years of math, we don't have time for our kids to learn how to do the stuff that they don't do going to college. And we have that in the smaller schools. Our kids learn how to run equipment a little bit out of school, do some welding, do some base stuff, and we don't have time left in our deal. We've literally took up all day of every day for them. My last one is a simple question. I got to reading the footnotes. And under a number of these boards, we're creating a whole bunch of new advisory boards and commissions, and it talks about what they do. And when you go to the footnotes, we got a $200 a day stipend on all of these. And I've never seen that. I went back and asked some appropriations people, and we normally do mileage and per diem. I'm yet to see these $200 stipends show up. I think it might be a bad place to start heading down the path on that, as many of these boards as we do. Thank you.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that I fully understand your first question, but what I have in the notes here is that one of the interview processes were eliminated, so that may be why the time from 30 to 15 days. The review process was amended. The school level score is under the Wyoming Accountability and Education Act, eliminating the intervening review of the Professional Judgment Panel, the PJP. Currently, the schools receive a score, and they can ask for review by that panel and then by the state board. The elimination of that first one was a recommendation by the state board because it was considered cumbersome.
go to Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question. It's probably as much for the Appropriations Committee as for the Chairman of the Education Committee. You know, that $1 million that we've rolled forward that we've had around for a while, and I asked my colleague from Cody, he thought it was school foundation program. It probably very well could be, but when I look at the budget bill, it talks about general fund dollars in there as well, so I think we ought to take a peek at that and see. It probably should all be foundation money. There may be some money there that might be reverted or should be reverted or is in the process of being reverted. I think that'd be something we'd like to know. Maybe you can get that for us.
Senator Rothfuss, our good friend from Devil's Tower is back in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll address the remaining questions that weren't covered by my colleague in the Education Committee. Regarding reporting requirements and the fact that they're too much, that's absolutely true. And one of the things that we've been focusing on both in the JEC and the Select Education Accountability is a way to merge as many of the reports as possible. We did that action through legislation a couple of years ago. We made a request to the department to find ways to bring all the reports together. They came back and we eliminated several reports that way. In this legislation, through there's a attempt to merge to the greatest degree possible the accreditation that's going on in the districts with the 5-year district assessment review and analysis. In other words, before you were doing two different processes, you were to a large degree cutting and pasting the answers, trying to put them in one document and report to two places. So one of the things that comes out of this education accountability draft here is bringing those together so that we don't have the duplication of reports, because we have heard a lot of testimony along those lines, and we're trying to be sensitive to that. There's a lot of reporting requirements, and we're trying to scale those back. The next point was with regard to small schools and the fact that we're scheduling 100%-ish of the day and that it's difficult for the math. Well, two concepts there. One is going back to the fact that even at the success curriculum, it still is 19 of 28 as the scheduling. So there's a lot of time available. I know it's difficult from the scheduling standpoint for some of the smaller schools based on the teachers they have available, but in terms of the strict scheduling of what the class is supposed to be, again, over a third of the courses are wide open, even under the most rigorous success curriculum. And the other circumstance, though, is if there's a problem where we can't do something like this, 4 years of math or the success curriculum, which is essentially what I'm hearing, that we couldn't do the success curriculum in a small school, that's a fundamental problem. That means that we are acting in an unconstitutional manner with respect to the Campbell decisions, and we're not providing adequate resources. So either they can do it with the resources we've given them for the small school model additions, in which case they should be able to accomplish this, or we need to understand that during recalibration so we can fix it and so that they can achieve all of the same things that you can get in a large school, because it's unacceptable from the Supreme Court standpoint that a small school wouldn't be able to meet all of these same standards of rigor. And finally, the $200 per day stipend. The concept there and the reason that's there is that there are teachers on the PJP and on the Technical Advisory Committee that, as you recall, the teacher contract doesn't include the summer. It includes, obviously, the fall and winter. So for those times, they wouldn't get the $200 stipend. But when they're off contract, they're paid a stipend. For administrators that are year-round employees, they wouldn't need to receive a stipend, and they don't receive a stipend if you read the details of that, because there's no necessity since they actually are an employee of the public and the state, and therefore we can call upon them. So that's the fairness and equity concept that we're trying to get to with the stipend, based on the fact that they're not employed at the time that we're trying to use them.
Anything else on Senate File 8? Further questions? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Senate File 8 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Coe, don't you be going the other direction.
Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 33. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 33, Precinct Committee Person Election, sponsored by the Corporations Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 7. Corporation Election Political Subdivision reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Meyer, Acting Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 33. Mr. Chairman, this was a product of your corporation's interim work. It's actually a bill that seems like everybody likes, and it came from our clerks, who have a tremendous workload right during and after an election to make sure that the elections work well, that the results are accurate, and as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of activity at that time. One of the things that happens at the primary election is that's when our parties, two major parties, precinct men and women, are elected. And their names are on the ballot, or frequently there's not a name on the ballot, and it's a write-in process, Mr. Chairman. It's probably the write-in process that kind of causes a lot of angst. And in many places, more than half of the precinct folks are written in. And in many cases, there are ties between different write-ins. A lot of people get one vote, believe it or not. And so then there has to be a process that the clerks have gone through to try to sort this out to find out who's elected. Well, at the same time, they've got the big election going on, you know, the candidates for the other offices, and they have a lot of pressure about that. It has to go to a canvassing board, and we've always treated the precinct men and women election, which is an extremely important election, Mr. Chairman, don't get me wrong, but we've forced that to all be decided in the same time frame as the canvassing board meets for the rest of the elections. And there's just there's a lot of precincts. Each precinct has a precinct man and a precinct woman, and there are two parties. And as you can imagine, this is a lot of work for our clerks to sort this through. In the end, what happens is a lot of times they don't have write-in votes for a precinct. No one filed for that precinct, and it ends up that is actually filled by the party itself. Happens a lot. What this bill does, Mr. Chairman, is to make a little bit of a safety valve in the system, and it allows the canvass for the precinct men and women to occur after the other canvass. And a canvass board is established by our county clerks. We've got some upstairs, and I'm sure they came down for this bill and not for the bill that's in the committee after this. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, that extra canvass will meet just to settle precinct men and women to review that vote. And what has also happened is that the clerks used to be required to get this all done and then send people a certificate of election. Well, this is really a party election that's administered by government, of course. And what's proposed in this bill is that there be a separate canvassing board that meets a little bit later. And then the results of that canvassing board are established. Those results are handed over to the parties, and the parties take and have their precinct meetings. They fill any remaining vacancies. They sort out when there are equal number of votes between the two, and so that's the way it works. And really, it is supported by everyone, Mr. Chairman. We looked at other ways to do this. Some clerks' offices said, you know, the precinct thing is a party thing. Why don't you parties go do that by convention? Well, the committee didn't like that. The committee didn't like other proposals in that area. We thought this was a really good compromise. And so the whole gist of the bill is on the second page, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I guess it's the third page. You see, we've struck language on page 2 about how it's done now. And on page 3, section D, says no later than 45 days after the date of the primary election, the county canvassing board or a canvassing board appointed by the county clerk consisting of two electors and the county clerk shall provide to each county chairman the certified election results for precinct committee men and committee women and a list of the persons who received write-in votes for precinct committee men or committee women if those write-in votes result in a tie. There's a little bit of language in the next section that deals with our transition from this year to future years. I don't really think we necessarily need to go into that.
But the key thing about all this is these precinct men and women will now take office in the 1st of January, and it will, you know, it's going to work. It actually is a great idea. It's going to work pretty well. So, as you can see, conforming language on page 4, under on lines 8 and 9, where instead of saying that the county chairman has received notice from the county clerk that all its members have been certified elected, clerk's not going to do that anymore. They're going to receive notice when The county central committee shall meet and organize under the direction of the county chairman at the time and place determined by the county chairman within 30 days after the term of its members begins. Term of its members is going to begin on in the 1st of January, Mr. Chairman, not when they receive these certificates from the clerk. Mr. Chairman, all the rest of the bill is existing language that tries to get us to page 6 and just brings all the things about when a vacancy is filled for an office of the state legislature. And what's important here is this is the biggest thing that precinct men and women do, is they fill vacancies. That's why it's an incredibly important job. But this deals with how it's done, because our previous law had in it a provision that made sure that there wasn't a stacking of appointments to precinct committee men and committee women when a vacancy occurs, when a vacancy in a legislative office occurs shortly after the primary election. And what could happen if you've got a lot of open seats for committee men and committee women and you have to fill a vacancy, you can envision someone stacking it, making appointments of people that are friendly to a particular situation, and you can imagine how that could be gamed. So the existing law prevented that from happening by saying they have to already be in office 30 days before the vacancy begins, or before the vacancy occurs. All this new language does here is conform that to the situation where they begin to take office on January 1st. So it applies the same principle so that it can't be gamed in the same way. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman. It really is a win-win. I think as it's drafted, I know of no one that opposes the bill. Clerks are happy. Secretary of State's happy. Committees seem to be happy. And the public seem to be happy, Mr. Chairman. Be happy to answer any questions. I'm happy.
Questions? Discussion? Questions on Senator Case's motion that Senate File 33 pass Committee of the Whole? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Senate File 33 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 11. The reading clerk, please read it in.
Senate File 11, Selling to Junk Dealers ID Required, sponsored by Senator Christensen. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, and Von Fladren, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on that fine little bill, Senate File 11. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask the reading clerk to read in the amendment.
Senate File 11, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 14.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I move the amendment, and I'll be explaining the bill.
Amendment's been moved. Would you like to discuss the amendment?
Ready to move the amendment?
Yeah, I thought you moved the amendment.
I did.
Are you ready for the question on the amendment?
I'm ready for the question on the amendment.
Question being called for on the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, the Standing Committee Amendment, Senate File 11, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment's been adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this is a bill about junkyards in Wyoming. When it comes to the price of metals, theft, and particularly copper, the damage and collateral replacement issues often far exceed the value of the stolen material. However, we typically only measure those in dollars and cents. Just a couple of stories here across the country. In McDowell County, West Virginia, lost landline calling capability as a result of the theft of copper communications cable. 2,500 feet of cable was discovered stolen. disrupting telephone service. That impacts emergency service. You're talking about December. Radio station back east was interrupted for several days due to the theft of 80 to 200 pounds of copper wire. Their transmitters were crippled during the theft, resulting in $50,000 to $60,000 in damages. We're seeing these kind of thefts out there that can impact county services, public affairs, and communities. I'd just like to dive into the bill. It's selling to junk dealers and an ID required. It's really all it is here, ladies and gentlemen. Requires a photo ID and or a vehicle identification or vehicle license plate to be recorded by the junk dealers. Down at the bottom of page one, we strike, do a little cleanup here on line 12, firm or corporation, and it just says every person engaged in the junk business shall keep a book in which all entries shall be written in ink in the English language and entered. Your amendment adds in on page, on line 14, behind book, where it says shall keep a book or dedicated computer software program. And later in that same line, it shall be written in a computer or ink. So a little bit of modernization for the junkyard bill. This law as it stands today. And then over on the top of page 2, line 1, transaction, it talks about what we're recording in the transaction, the following information. New language in here. We're going to get rid of, in the English language, clean that up a little bit. And then down on line 9, where it says the name of, in double I, the name and residence of the person buying or selling the junk metal or rubber goods. Line 11, the license plate of the person's vehicle, if applicable. And then the amendment adds in or for the paragraph, the new paragraph on line 14, a photocopy of their United States federal or state-issued identification, including a driver's license, passport, passport card, and or military identification card. And then the last part of that amendment that adds new language is on line 20, no entry in such book, new language, or computer shall be erased, mutilated, or changed. I gave you a little bit of a story about the other side of the state. Now, if you'd bear with me here, just Cheyenne. Sunday, the 24th, 2014, Cheyenne police are looking for a man who shot another after being caught in the act of stealing from the victim's truck. About 5:20 in the morning, Sunday, police were called to a residence. 29-year-old Cheyenne was shot after interrupting an apparent vehicle burglary. The victim had gone outside for a smoke when he heard what he believed was tampering near his work truck. Upon investigations, he discovered a male suspect pulling copper lead wire from a roll on the truck. Upon the interruption, the suspect reportedly pulled a handgun and fired one shot at the victim, hitting him in the upper body. The suspect fled the area on foot. This is a crime that happens all across America. It's big in the West in our unpopulated districts. All this is a little bill to help provide better identification on who is selling scrap copper, rubber, metal products to our junkyards. I've talked with this bill about, or with our largest, I believe it's our largest junkyard buyer or junk buyer in Wyoming over in the city of Casper. They already do these practices. They record the driver's license. They take pictures. If they don't have an ID, they go out and record the vehicle's license plates. They're fully in support of it and encourage this to try to clean up this industry. And I'd ask your support for this bill.
Further discussion, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, last weekend when I went home, I took copy of this bill to a neighbor of mine who is in the recycling business up in Casper and said, what about this? And what she said was, and just what was reported earlier, for the large purchases, the significant ones, this is good practice. She said, that's what we do. That's what the reputable people in the business do. So for that part of it, this bill serves a useful purpose in terms of the people that aren't yet adopting the good practices. This will require it. The issue that we both saw with it was, if you look at the provisions on page 2, it speaks to all junk metal or rubber goods. This particular establishment recycles aluminum cans. And, you know, people bring in a garbage can, a bushel basket, whatever, full of aluminum cans, and they get paid anywhere from, depending on how many, $2 to $15 or whatever the it in terms of how much weight you brought in. It's just people collecting their own cans, and maybe a few off the roadside or some other place they happen to find them, taking them in and recycling them. And the way it's worded, presuming it wasn't changed since we didn't discuss the standing committee amendment, presuming that didn't change it, it's all metal goods. That includes aluminum cans. The record keeping here would make that business cost prohibitive and simply force any private entity out of that business. And I would like the sponsor to respond to that and like to think, what should we do in a second or third reading amendment so that this doesn't impinge on that kind of recycling business where, frankly, stealing them is not an issue, not a problem, but the cost of complying with this would be a problem.
Senator Anderson, District 28.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to object to the wording of this bill, and I can't change the headliner, I know, but for the recycle business, I think they would not like junk dealers. When you think of a junk dealer, you think of something that has no value. And for 40 years, we recycled copper, chrome, brass, stainless steel, aluminum, and steel, got paid for every bit of it. It is valuable product. And there are big recyclers in this area that recycle this material all the time, and it's a valuable product. And to diminish their name to junk dealers is probably not the right thing to do.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would remind the body of the adage that one man's junk is another man's treasure. Mr. Chairman, the entire chapter, all of Chapter 18 is entitled, in fact, Junk Dealers, and the term junk dealer is used throughout that title. So we appreciate that, but nevertheless, that's kind of the way it is.
You probably where the phrase junkyard dog comes from. Yeah. Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. appreciate the wise senator from Natrona County to the heartland of Casper there to help enlighten us. But it is. It's a junk statute. And while this was one of the questions that came up when we were crafting it, because there's a lot more recycling going on out there, but it all falls under that title. And so I would wholeheartedly encourage another senator to move us into the new age and rename this entire statute. But this section, but that's probably not today's business. As for the aluminum can issue, again, it kind of falls into this statute that talks about junk, and to separate out and try and identify aluminum cans, I think we may just be causing ourselves some problems. I'm not sure if we talked to the same operator in Casper, but when I visited with both his wife and him separately, they didn't see any problem with this, and I didn't see that they were differentiating the product. They were recording all transactions, and it was just a matter of standard practice. And I'd encourage us to hold it at that line for now.
Further discussion on Senate File 11. You ready for question? Senator Von Flatern.
Sorry to interrupt here, Mr. Chairman, but we did amend in a word "or" on line 22 of page 2, so just to write down the license plate number is not an onerous task for these people.
Okay.
Question.
Question being called for. Questions on Senator Christensen's motion that Senate File 11 pass committee of the whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 11 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 9. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 9, Right to Farm, sponsored by Senator Bebout. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Fladeren, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd move the one Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 9. I believe there is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask the reading clerk to read in the amendment.
Senate File 9, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
I'd move the amendment, and to further discuss the bill and amendments, I'd ask you to call on our Majority Floor Leader, Mr. Bebout.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member of the Senate, I bring to you Senate File 9, and the title is appropriate because that's exactly what the bill is about, Right to Farm. And member of the Senate, I'll explain a little background about why I bring this bill to you, and then I'll get into the specifics of the bill. But as you all know, it continues to be a day-to-day attack on the West and our way of life in many, many different ways by the federal government through rulemaking processes, primarily through the EPA and other areas. And I would speak specifically the one that the EPA is doing calling WOTUS, Waters of the U.S., where they're making a move to really try to regulate all waters in our state, which is in direct violation of our Constitution, including irrigation ditches, and these kinds of things. So what this bill does, what it attempts to do, is just to put into statutes a little bit more of a definition about what farming and ranching is about in Wyoming. We all know the importance of it. We all know how important it is to Wyoming, to our revenues, to the people in our great state. And so what this does, and I'll get into the bill, Mr. Chairman, and there are existing statutes, by the way, to talk about the right to farm, and there's it's called the Wyoming Right to Farm and Ranch Act, and there's existing language in there, and there's also farm and ranch operations not considered a nuisance, and that's also in our present statute. This goes a little bit further, Mr. Chairman, and what I did, I checked around surrounding states to see how they deal with this, because a lot of states in our nation, and particularly in the West, but not only in the West, are looking at putting more into statutes about the right to farm. And there was two ways to do it when I first looked at this. One would be a statutory change, another is a constitutional amendment. I thought the constitutional amendment went too far to try to have a right for that. Other states have done that. Specifically, Missouri just passed one very similar to what this bill does, but I chose to do it by statute. Mr. Chairman, what it does, if you read the bill, it's 11-44-104, the right to farm, and we talk about it being a vital part of the economy of Wyoming that shall have rights forever guaranteed. If you go to page 2, we talk about nothing is construed to modify any provision of common law or statutes relating to trespass, eminent domain, existing or previously enacted laws or rules. And then we get into the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman. And what I did is I added a definition further under 11-44-104, and you can see what the Standing Committee Amendment is. It describes farm and ranch operations, includes any farm or ranch practice recognized as generally accepted under the provisions of Wyoming Statute 11-44-103 in agriculture or livestock management practice. And that's another article, Mr. Chairman, under the ag part of our article, Article 11. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see if there are any questions on the amendment. And if there are, I would glad to answer them. Otherwise, I call for the question on the amendment.
We're on the Standing Committee Amendment. Any discussion? Questions on the Senator Christensen's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 9. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The Standing Committee Amendment has been adopted. Back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that really is the bill. I stand for questions or call for the question.
Questions or discussion on Senate File 9? Questions on Senator Christensen's motion to Senate File 9 pass Committee of the Whole? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 9 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration, Senate File 17. The reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 17, Resident Contractor Materials Preference, sponsored by Senator Bebout. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Hastert, Ross, Wasserberger, excuse, Senator Perkins, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Beebe, out the Appropriations Committee is off the floor. Would you like to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would. Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole Ryan report to do so with a favorable recommendation and Senate File 17 do pass. Resident contractors material preference, and I will explain the bill, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in 2013, the Minerals Committee did an extensive interim study on trying to make what we have of the contractor's preference law better, more understandable, and more protect the rights of our resident contractors, and we all know what that's all about in the 5% preference rule. What happened, Mr. Chairman, is when we did that, there was a conflict in the language of that and an interpretation taken by our own YDOT relative to materials. What happened, Mr. Chairman, is brought to my attention by a colleague, actually a constituent of my colleague from Fremont County that had bid or solicited a bid on some equipment to YDOT, and they said that the preference law was no longer in effect. And so through contacts, I was made aware of that, and my colleague from Fremont County and I got into the issue. And what had happened when we did that bill in 2013, there was a change made to that bill, and if you look at the existing language, you'll see the change was in 16.6.105, existing language, where they inserted the word major maintenance, and because they said major maintenance in that particular category, it was opinion of the AG for YDOT that you could not include the preference, and we requested a further to knowledge of that or investigation of that, and as I understand it, there's a attorney a general's opinion coming whether that is in fact right or wrong, but we didn't want to wait. We understand sometimes what those AG's opinions are, so we decided to come with a bill to make that correction. Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill does, and it also, if you look at 16.6.105, you'll see that it's a rewrite of that complete statute, and this is one of our statutes that has a one-page paragraph that's one sentence. And so when you see this, when you look at the existing law, it looks a lot different than what's in the existing law, but it's just a rewrite in a way that I think makes it a lot clearer. And, Mr. Chairman, when you go to page 2, you can see the provisions that really make this work so we're consistent and do what we want to do, which is provide that 5% preference. And specifically, if you go to page 2, line 18, where we say major maintenance and regular maintenance, that includes the definition of materials, which you see there, which would, in fact, allow when you bid equipment in the state of Wyoming under the contractor's preference, you would receive that preference. Then the other thing we did, Mr. Chairman, is an existing law. It had the word may. And if you'll look at the front of the page on page 1, line 14, we insert the word shall. So, Mr. Chairman, what this does, it takes care of that glitch that we had in 2013, fixes it. So we will have a contractor's preference. I would stand for any questions.
Questions on Senate File 17. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I commend the majority floor leader. Essentially, he had me at hello on this one. But I did have a quick question. Paragraph 4 on page 3. I just was sitting here wondering, if you were a purchaser for a public agency, who's going to determine if those materials are of inferior quality, and where's that going to come from? Where's that decision? Where's that going to be adjudicated? How's that going to come down? Just maybe a little conversation about that.
Senator Beebout?
Mr. Chairman, that's an existing provision that we have in our law, and it's something that we always allow that latitude that if they are inferior, and it's the way we rewrote the definition to cover that. It's something that's been done. We allow that latitude for YDOT. It would be like when if they bid a grader, a motor grader, and they're looking at a John Deere or Caterpillar or one of those of that quality, and something brand X shows up, that they have that latitude to be able to do that.
Further discussion on Senate File 17. Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the sponsor. The city of Sheridan, very often, instead of bidding machines out, materials out, would simply buy off of the state purchasing contract, figuring that was competitive and we'd understood we could do that under law. Would this bill change that, or would local government still have the ability to buy directly off the state purchasing contract?
Senator Beebout.
Mr. Chairman, I would think nothing changes because I'd have to get into those specific statutes and see where that authority is, but all we're talking about here is the 5% preference relative to the normal purchasing agreement. So my guess would be, and it's a guess, but I'll get a further answer for you, is that nothing changes. You still do that, but you still have the 5% preference as you have before in the same situation.
Further discussion on Senate File 17. Questions on Senator Bebout's motion that Senate File 17 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 17 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill and last bill for our consideration, Senate File 82. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 82, Funeral Services Practitioners Act Amendment, sponsored by Senator Scott. It was referred to committee number 3. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Kinski, Landon, Peterson, excuse, Senator Case, Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it offers a do pass on Senate File 82. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask for the reading clerk to read that amendment at this time.
Senate File 82, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, corrected copy, page 1, line 2.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For further, I would move Senate File, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Senate File 82. And for further explanation on this good Senate file, I'd turn the time over to our good Senator, Senator Scott.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. On the Standing Committee Amendment, which has been read in and moved, Mr. Chairman, Standing Committee Amendment does two things. There was a glitch in the drafting process. We had two approaches to the problem, drafted, picked one of them, and we wound up with both of them in the bill. As an accident and a miscommunication. And that's the deletion at the bottom of page 2. And the top of page 3. And then on page 6, line 7, there's correcting a typo that makes quite a difference in the meaning. And, Mr. Chairman, it was we put employer in, and employee was what was intended. That's a fair difference. But I swear, Mr. Chairman, a whole bunch of us, half a dozen of us, looked at that, didn't see it, and then a fresh set of eyes did see it and caught this. And so that's what this does. It corrects that typo.
We're on the Standing Committee Amendment. All in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 82 has been adopted. Back on the bill, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, this is a cleanup on the Funeral Services Practitioner Act that we passed last year in the budget session. That was a 72-page bill. This cleans up a couple problems. It was brought to my attention by my local funeral director. They were their funeral directors, but they weren't embalmers. Embalmers became funeral service practitioners. And there was a grandfather clause inserted to make sure that they and anybody likewise situated could continue to operate their business the way they always had. Turned out the way that was placed in the statute when the attorneys looked at it carefully in the AG's office, the grandfather clause was ineffective. And that was the initial motivation from the bill. I told them, go talk to your statewide organization, go talk to your board, licensing board, see if they found any other glitches, and they had, and the result was this bill comes forward with the support of those groups as well as the local folks up in my county. And let me explain what it does. First, we needed, and this is taking care of the ineffective grandfather clause, we needed to broaden the funeral director definition. So it included operation of a crematory. This does that on page 2. The amendment on page 3 is simply conforming. On page 4, there's a section that speaks to permits. They're trying to separate the licensee from the permittee, the permit on operating these crematories, and in general, that's a correction they sought. On bottom page 4, on the list of people who can be in the embalming room, they missed apprentices. The board asked for that to come in. Larger amendment is over on page 6, where they talk about what actually goes on in the crematory. Key language there is no employee, starting on line 7, who is not a funeral service practitioner should handle human remains or open closed crematory container. But there is provision in the first part of it and the latter part of it that you can have somebody else assist, and they can actually conduct the cremation process as long as it's a closed container. And that's the standard practice, and we wanted to make sure that was allowed. And then the board, pursuant to authority in 3316.534 that's not included in this, had promulgated a regulation saying that these employees and their funeral service practitioners that were supervising them had to go through a crematory or chemical disposition operator certification program approved by the board. Testimony is those are readily available. They'll bring them in. What had happened was they think they've got the authority already. It was questioned by, I think, the Attorney General's people again. I can see where the lawyers would be coming from on that one, and this makes it crystal clear they've got that authority. It didn't appear to be at all controversial, but it makes it clear they do have that authority. And then we persuaded them that we needed to have an out in case something went wrong. So you see the last sentence, the board may waive or extend the time to complete the certification program due to hardship or the difficulty, things can go wrong. You can get your certification course all scheduled, and you don't get there because there's a death in the family, there's a wedding, you get sick, all the things that people are subject to. You need to give the board a little wiggle room to deal with those circumstances, because you're basically dealing mostly with people who mostly know what they're doing on this. And so that's, Mr. Chairman, that's a very quick summary of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussions on this good little dead bill? Further discussion? The questions on, let's see, who moved that? I'm trying to remember. Senator Peterson's motion that Senate File 82 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 82 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Mr. President.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 26, do pass. Senate File 14, do pass amended. Senate File 8, do pass amended. Senate File 33, do pass. Senate File 11, do pass amended. Senate File 9, do pass amended. Senate File 17, do pass, and Senate File 82, do pass amended. Senator Cole, co-chairman.
Senator Cope. Mr. President, I move for adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's been adopted. Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Introduction of Senate files. Senate File 94, first reading.
Senate File 94, Substance Abuse Assessment Non-Residents, sponsored by Senator Christensen.
Senate File 94 is assigned to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 96, first reading.
Senate File 96, Special Investigator, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss.
Senate File 96 is assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Senate File 98, first reading.
Senate File 98, School Athletic Safety, sponsored by Senator Landon.
Senate File 98 is assigned to Committee Number 4, Education. Senate File 93, first reading.
Senate File 93, County Road Fund Pavement Management, sponsored by Senator Anderson, O2.
Senate File 93 is assigned to Committee Number 6, Transportation. It is going to be assigned to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 95, first reading.
Senate File 95, Speed Limits, sponsored by Senator Cole.
Senate File 95 is assigned to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 97, first reading.
Senate File 97, Department of Transportation Communication Facility, sponsored by Senator Meyer.
Senate File 97 is assigned to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 92, first reading.
Senate File 92, Workers' Compensation County Elected Officials, sponsored by Senator Cole.
Senate File 92 is assigned to Committee Number 9, Minerals. Do you have any other work, any other messages? Mr. Chairman, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk if there's no other motions by members. Incidentally, with respect to the re-referrals, we just need to catch those before we actually make the motion to adjourn. Yesterday we made a referral motion after your motion, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. So I know we're moving quickly, so we'll just give sort of a pause before we ask for your motion. Let's go to Senator Scott. Did you want to speak before or after the motion? Okay. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that does clear the desk. Announcement, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, your Senate Labor Committee will be meeting almost immediately. Let's try to get there by 4:45 on Senate File 66. We're going to hear from Director Forslund. He's going to explain both Senate File 66 and the share plan versions of Medicaid expansion. And it's set up in 302. all the senators are invited, and we've invited the House, and we're hoping to get, this will be the main explanation of that from the Health Department.
We encourage all of you to attend. You know that it's you're going to be called to vote on it sometime, whether it's a budget amendment or otherwise. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet up on adjournment. In room S-14, we will consider Senate File 81, Lifesaver Program 2, and Senate File 19, VIN Inspections.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your travel committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning, January 22nd at 8 a.m. in room S-14 at the top of the stairs to consider the following bill, Senate File 63, Predator Ownership.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water, will meet tomorrow, January 22nd, upon adjournment in room S-15. We will meet in room S-15 to consider Senate File 6, Aquatic Invasive Species, Senate File 46, Fire Misdemeanors, and Senate File 56, Study on Transfer of Public Land.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you very much. As previously noted, the announcement made at noon about the 6 privacy bills, data privacy bills, we're going to start at 7 a.m. tomorrow, so I'm just making that note. And got the good chairman of the Data Privacy Task Force here and all the members of the committee, 7 a.m.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, Thursday, January 22nd, 30 minutes after the noon recess, to continue our discussion on the Senate File 42 Task Force on Mineral Taxes.
Any further announcements? There being none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. The Senate shall be adjourned until tomorrow at 10 a.m.